Welcome again to Knowing the Score with me, Tony Westwood. This is a place in which we explore how composers and arrangers, like Dmitri Shostakovich, whose orchestration of Vincent Heumann's T for Two is our signature tune, how they use orchestral instruments in their compositions and scores. We come this week to the string section. As we did with the woodwinds and the brass, we will start at the top of the section as it appears on the score, so it is the violins in the spotlight. Violins make up the bulk of the orchestra from Baroque to modern, so I have been a little remiss to leave them so long. Indeed, I think I can hear them buzzing angrily. The string section, living together as they have since the dawn of orchestral ensemble playing, are the most cohesive of the orchestral groups. I think, therefore, that I'm going to help us tune into the group before we single out the smallest members, the violins. I'll be quick. Violins, violas, cellos, double basses. Four instruments, a quartet of sounds, soprano, alto, tenor, bass. But that's not exactly the way it works. The double basses are too gruff to hold a voice on their own, so they often share the bass voice with the cellos. Half of the cellos sometimes, all of them mostly in Baroque and classical scores. So the violins play in two groups, called first violins, soprano voice, and second violins, alto voice. It might have been nicer to call them less divisive hierarchical names, but there we are. So, with the violas playing tenor much of the time, occasionally with the cellos joining, we have our string choir with all bases covered. Definitely a happy family. That string sound provides the basis for most Baroque and classical music. In Baroque polyphony, each string part has its say with the theme, as in this Brandenburg Concerto by Bach. Polyphonic, that is, multiple voices, string writing by J.S. Bach, the third movement of his third Brandenburg Concerto. Alternatively, in Baroque and classical string writing, the first violins take the tune and the other strings accompany, as in this famous bit of J.S. Bach. Thank you. First violins taking the air while the rest of the strings work in the kitchen. We'll come back to this piece later in the programme. So who needs winds, brass and percussion? Many string players ask that question because as soon as those instruments arrive, strings run the risk of becoming accompanying also-rans. Our friend from Programme 2, the oboe, relegating the string section to subservience in the trio from Haydn's Miracle Symphony. But, on behalf of all composers and arrangers, I'm here to show that we did not lose our imaginations to ingratiation of the wind instruments. Indeed, their presence freed the strings from the quartet-playing strictures, as I will demonstrate. Let's see if I have mollified the violins. That's a relief. A little bit more about the string family before we concentrate on violins. They all depend on taut strings held tense by a piece of wood called the bridge. The strings extend along the neck of the instrument, and resonance is supplied by the hollow-shaped body of the instrument. The usual sounds are produced by moving the hairs of a bow across the strings over holes in the body of the instrument. That's where we get the sounds that film score writers and arrangers love. Big string sounds beloved by the Romantics with small and big R's. Those were written by Rachmaninoff, the 18th variation from his Paganini variations, and Tchaikovsky, the love theme from the Romeo and Juliet overture. But it doesn't have to sound like that. In that example, the string players are adding to the richness of the sound by vibrating the finger that chooses the note on the neck of the instrument. Here is what happens without that vibration known as vibrato. Thank you. another air, this time by Handel, with no vibrato from the strings, producing a more plain sound. The string player can also move the bow closer to the bridge or over the fingerboard to produce different textures to the sound. Occasionally they can be called upon to turn the bow upside down and bounce the wood on the strings. String players also carry a mute, which they can place over the bridge to produce muzzy sounds, muted strings. That is a very special sound, as here in Rusalka's Song to the Moon by Dvořák. And of course, one can dispense with the bow altogether and pluck the strings. Pizzicato, as in Johann Strauss's Pizzicato Polka. Was Leo Delibes doubling in pizzicato in his ballet Sylvia. Pizzicato can be used tunefully, as in this famous symphonic example that has all the strings plucking away very quickly, orchestrated by Tchaikovsky. Harmonious pizzicato in Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, the third movement. Or pizzicato can be used to give a quasi-percussive sound. Pizzicato pizzicato strings prepared by Claude Debussy in the last section of his Iberia. Versatility, thy name is string section. Before we single out the violins, we will get there, I promise. Here's a piece in which each section enters independently to give a sense of the progressive deepness of the string quartet from violin through to double bass, and also shows the agility of the string section as fleet fingers run across the fingerboard. This is from the overture to Smetana's opera, The Bartered Bride. And there we leave all the strings and focus, at last, on the violins. Violins hardly ever play on their own because they are soprano instruments demanding accompaniment. No, while that is usually true, in the next two examples they move into the stratosphere, divide up, and produce ravishing ethereal sounds all on their own. Celestial violins from Wagner, the prelude to Act I of his opera Lohengrin, and how Verdi starts the decline of his tragic heroine known as La Traviata. I sense that the first violins are just itching to show what they are made of by continuing that Traviata piece. First, they share the ravishing theme with the violas and cellos, playing an octave lower, while the second violins dutifully play the unexciting pom-pom of the pom-pom accompaniment. The seconds continue to do this, while the first violins later split up to play a filigree counterpoint to the tune, then held by the lower strings all the way to the end of the piece. If you are the type who always supports the underdog, listen to the pom-pom. If not, take the simple joy of divided first violins orchestrated by Giuseppe Verdi. Violins, firsts in the limelight, seconds subordinate but essential, in the famous prelude to La Traviata by Verdi. The first violins were playing in their instrument's higher register. Here's a quick summary of the range of a violin. A solo violin helter-skelter scale from Richard Strauss's Till Eulenspiegel's Merry Pranks, ending on an open G string, the violin's lowest note. That note is the only one in which the violinist cannot make a vibrato sound. It is an open string, there is no finger on the fingerboard to vibrate. This makes it awkward for composers writing in certain keys, because this note stands out like a sore thumb from its neighbours in terms of timbre. Here are a few open G strings for you to identify. Where do they appear? The very first note of the first two items is an open G. Thank you. The first Mars bars that Holst wrote in his Planet Suite, ending that string of open strings. I hope you could hear that rather coarse sound of the open G string. In order, they came from the big tune in Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance March No. 4, the open G start from the larghetto of his Serenade for Strings, the finale of Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik, Lehár's Gold and Silver Waltz, and the big tune from the finale of Brahms's First Symphony, and then the finale of Elgar's Enigma Variations. Quite a list of open G strings. And while we're here, let's give the G string a little air. Not as Bach wrote it, but the air from the suite in D that we heard earlier arranged by Leopold Stokowski. The thick G string gives that full sound, so sometimes composers and arrangers, as Stokowski did there with Bach's tune transposed down an octave, they dictate that the violin players should not move onto other strings so that the sound has a continuing fullness. Here's an example from Rachmaninoff, a very famous tune. At the start of his second piano concerto, made richer by the use of the whole violin section's G strings. The Elgar Pomp and Circumstance No. 4 March tune is also played on the G string, open strings and all. Talking of open strings. That was Aaron Copland imitating violins, playing open strings in the preparation for a hoedown from his ballet Rodeo. Let's let the orchestral fiddles...
Fiddle? Fiddle indeed!
...have some more fun with more from Copland's hoedown. fiddles at the radio and violins leading the dance. Here's another fiddle tuning up to lead a dance. Not quite in tune, Your Infernal Majesty, but enough of a devil's tune in Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre to conjure up a devil's revel for the violins to enjoy. Dawn and a cock crow on the oboe bring the violin's revelry and devilry to an end in Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre. And while we are in fiddle mode and in G minor, here is some Romany Fire, orchestrated by Johannes Brahms, complete with the open G string near the beginning for us to enjoy. gypsy violins in Brahms's first Hungarian dance, much of that rich sound is played at the lower half of the bow pressing into the strings. The part of the bow nearest to the player's hand is called the heel. Composers and arrangers can specify that they want notes to be played using the heel. This makes a heavy sound. The violinists lift the bow and drag the heel back over the string for every note. Here's an example of this type of playing from Petrushka by Stravinsky, The Dance of the Coachman. Both violin groups played the same notes there, and they all played two notes at a time, known as double stopping. Now we go to the other end of the violinist's bow, the tip. A very different sound is obtained by rapid, small back and forth movements, tremolando in Italian, trembling, usually very softly. Here is Stravinsky again, the Firebird. We start with the violins playing very high notes, while the bassoon sings a lullaby. Then, as they descend, the tremolando begins. It stops briefly and begins again high up, creating a magical atmosphere in preparation for the horn solo that starts the final scene of the ballet. You can also use this back and forth bowing on a note in loud passages, but not as rapidly as the tremolando we've just heard. Here is Wagner using it to provide added excitement to the brass fanfares in the prelude to Act 3 of Lohengrin. Galloping strings from Wagner's Lohengrin. Very different from the high Lohengrin strings with which we started our violin explorations earlier. And one can use this technique to produce an agitated sound, as Mahler does at the start of his Second Symphony. Thank you. Jean Sibelius, the Finnish composer, had a penchant for using tremolando strings, sometimes for long stretches. This is quite a strain on the violins, both firsts and seconds, as well as the rest of the string band. An extended section of tremolando for the strings to endure, courtesy of Sibelius in the first movement of his Fifth Symphony. I can imagine the relief of the violins when they got the tune at the end of that segment and could at last stretch their bow arms. We're coming towards the end of the programme, and we haven't completed our exploration of violin orchestration. I have asked the violas if they would be willing to share part of their programme next week with the violins. They, kind souls that they always are, have said yes. So let's end this programme by looking at how Ravel uses the violins in his Bolero. I wonder how your memorisation of the Bolero theme is going. Only 4 weeks to go, folks. They do, eventually about 10 minutes in, get to play the tune. Well, the first violins do, but before that they have to do a lot of quiet plucking accompaniment. Ravel never allows both groups of violins to play at the same time. Each group is divided into two parts, each part plucking 3 strings at a time on beats 2 and 3 of the 3-beat bar. The lower strings are plucking simultaneously. This is what it sounds like. This is the first violin segment. Gap 2, 3. So, after 10 minutes of this, the firsts get to play the tune, divided in two, playing an octave apart, with all the woodwinds, so they don't have the tune all to themselves. As the firsts play, the seconds are still divided into two, now plucking all 4 of their strings on the 2nd and 3rd beats of the bar. Thank you. Then, after that, all the violins come in together, divided up to play a four-part version of the big tune, Ravel making the best of his violin resources to beef up his hypnotic tune, and giving all listeners the last chance for this programme to get the first half of his tune right. One, two, three, go! Two, three. And we will play out with all the violins in octaves playing the second half of the tune. Sing along while Tony Westwood, knowing the score, and the violins say goodbye till next week. Goodbye.